Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, the Washington Post ran an investigative series called Top Secret America. It revealed that the vast secret government has become so massive and unaccountable that most people, including those with top secret security clearance, can't even explain what it does or how big it is. In last Tuesday's piece, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, quote, "This is a terrible confession. I can't get a number on how many contractors work for the Office of the Secretary of Defense." The Washington Post's William Arkin and Dana Priest report that of 845,000 people with top security clearances, 265,000 are contractors. They also report that the official U.S. intelligence budget was $75 billion last year. It's doubled in size since 9/11. But that figure does not include many military activities or homeland security, so it could be double that amount. Tim Shorrock, the independent journalist we had on Friday's show, has reported that 70% of the intelligence budget was spent on private contractors. Tim and other independent journalists have been writing about government secrets for years, but papers like the Washington Post haven't followed their lead about the privatization of intelligence until now. Last Tuesday, just 24 hours after the first story ran, the Senate's Intelligence Committee removed a provision from the Intelligence Authorization Act, which would have given the Government Accountability Office greater oversight over the government's secret intelligence programs. Back in March, President Obama threatened to veto the bill if it included that provision. So who's keeping tabs on all of the secret activity, everything from billion-dollar contracts to corporations to the privatization of intelligence? Up until now, we've relied on courageous whistleblowers and journalists to give us this information, but we're now entering new territory with WikiLeaks. On Sunday, WikiLeaks released 90,000 pages of classified material exposing what's really happening in Afghanistan. So what does this all mean for our democracy? On today's Your Call, we're talking about government secrets. How can we take on the secret government? Can these secrets be unraveled? And if so, what do we do with all of that information? Ray McGovern is a former CIA analyst and Army intelligence officer. Ray's intelligence work began during his service in the U.S. Army and continued in the CIA, where he worked as an analyst for 27 years under seven different presidents. As co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, he's now speaking out against corruption in the CIA. And Ray McGovern joins us from Washington. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you, Rose.
It's great to have you. We are also joined by Trevor Paglen. He is an artist, writer, and experimental geographer. His first book, Torture Taxi, On the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights, was the first book to systematically describe the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. His second book, I Could Tell You, But Then You Would Have to Be Destroyed by Me, and is an examination of the visual culture of black military programs. This year, he published his first photographic monograph called Invisible, Covert Operations and Classified Landscapes. And Trevor joins us in studio. Hi, Trevor. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Ray McGovern, let's start off with you. Government secrets are obviously nothing new, but we are entering some new territory. What really strikes you about what we're facing today?
Well, let's start with the WikiLeaks business. The mainstream press, so-called, I call it the fawning corporate media because that's what it is, the same media that led us into war with Iraq and threatens to lead us into war in Iran, they have made the fourth estate, so to speak, defunct. Okay, there is no fourth estate. There is no free press in this country, writ large. There are community radio stations. There are certain people trying to spread some truth around. But by and large, if you look at the media, they're all bought by the corporate folks. And yesterday was a very good example of that, since the White House got up and said, oh, these 90,000 documents, they are nothing new. There's nothing in there. And as soon as they had said that, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and all the cable channels just regurgitated it. Nothing in there. Well, there's a lot in there. There's an incredible amount of interesting information. It's all firsthand. It's all documentary. These are the Army records, what's been going on in Afghanistan. And so it's really ludicrous for the phone and corporate media to say anything else. What we have here, more generally speaking, is good news, and that is that with the fourth estate defunct, we have a fifth estate. And that estate exists out in the ether beyond the control of any government or any corporation. It exists out there when whistleblower websites like WikiLeaks decides to put information up there that can be accessed by the likes of you and me. This is revolutionary. This is the answer to many prayers in terms of getting information out to the public that is capriciously labeled secret just to avoid government embarrassment. And it's precisely what Daniel Ellsberg has been calling on people to do for decades now. What Dan says is, don't do what I did in Vietnam when I delayed releasing these things until it was well into the war, and the cumbersome process through which he had to Xerox all this material and make it available to the various newspapers, well, gosh, no longer does he have the need to worry about that. No longer does anyone have to worry about that. All they have to do is find a secure way to access WikiLeaks, and no one will know the provenance of this or that message. So this is truly revolutionary. And if people do take the time to look at what's in these documents, they will see, for example, we are funding the Pakistanis to the tune of maybe $5 billion a year. What's happening to that money? Well, guess what? A lot of that money is going through the Pakistani intelligence service right into funding who? The Taliban or some al-Qaeda. You see, the Pakistanis do not share our objectives in Afghanistan, and so they work directly at cross purposes. And, this has always been suspected, but never did we have documentary evidence of the scale on which they're encouraging the insurgents. They're paying them. They're devising operational methods for them. The Pakistanis are acting vis-a-vis Afghanistan just as the North Vietnamese used to act vis-a-vis the South Vietnamese. So what do we do then? Well, we started bombing North Vietnam. And what are we doing now? We're bombing Pakistan, the places where the insurgents are. It never stops. And what will not stop is the insurgency in Afghanistan, because the main people funding and providing the instruments for that are the Pakistanis, and they don't give a darn about U.S. interests there. All they care about is India. All Pakistan has ever cared about is India, and their major objective is simply to deny India the right to have predominant influence in Afghanistan. So, our ambassador knew that. He told Barack Obama that in November, two famous cables which were made available to the New York Times, November 6 and November 9, he made it clear as a bell. Look, in addition to all these other things, like Karzai not being a reliable partner, like the Afghan army being beyond repair and not trainable, there's this other thing, and that is that the insurgents, the people who are fighting, are all in the border area, and Pakistan does not share our view as to what's necessary. As a matter of fact, they have the opposite policy.
So, and we'll talk about more about that on our Friday show when we would dig into media coverage of the WikiLeaks classified information that they leaked on Sunday. Trevor Paglen, you've written several books about the top secret government secrets. What really strikes you about what we're facing today?
I guess in my latest book, Blank Spots on the Map, I think I try to deal with this question of the secret state and look at its origins and look at what's going on with it now. I think what strikes me about it now at this moment is, first of all, the scale of it. The scale of this part of the state is larger than it has ever been. Previously, the historic highs were in the late 1980s at the height of the Cold War. Now it's bigger than that. we're talking again about, as you mentioned, $75 billion intelligence budget. There's about a 50-something billion dollar black budget, as it's called. These are the unaccounted for dollars in the defense budget. And the black budget and the intelligence budget are kind of like a Venn diagram. They overlap in places and are separate from one another in other places. So I think there's a question about scale. The second thing is about the ways in which powers attributed to the secret state or come from the secret state have just become a normal part of how the government works. Examples of that being things like the use of the state secrets privilege, which was once a very kind of obscure precedent in the court system that administrations could use to keep evidence out of lawsuits where classified evidence might come up. And this was a way to quash lawsuits and essentially keep top secret programs out of the court system. You know, in the last 10 years or so, that privilege has been used over and over and over again, far more often than it has been used historically. It was a very odd thing to do in the past. So I think that speaks to the my final point about it, which is the degree to which this secret state in its various forms has become normalized in a lot of ways. This is no longer some kind of exceptional, dirty little thing that the government does in the shadows, but is very much a part of the overall structure of the state itself.
We got an email from a listener, Ray, who said, of course the government keeps secrets. I haven't trusted them for years. The question is, can these secrets be unraveled?
Well, I think it has to be said that there are such things as legal secrets, information that should be kept secret. But in terms of the other stuff, the stuff that's labeled secret simply to avoid government embarrassment or graft or ineptitude, yeah, that can be unraveled, but not by the mainstream press. They have an allergy to that kind of thing. Excuse me. So what needs to happen is honest investigative reporters have to get on the beat here and unravel this. And Dana Priest is one of those, and I congratulate her on her contribution here in the Washington Post.
What are your thoughts on that, Trevor? There's Jane Mayer, for example, has written a book about this. Tim Shorrock, Jeremy Scahill. I mean, there are a lot of books out about what's happening right now.
Absolutely. I tend to be perhaps a little bit less cynical about the role that the mainstream media can play in understanding some of this material. For example, if we look at the WikiLeaks disclosure, began looking at it yesterday. It's $90,000 of 90,000 pages. I'm sorry, of basically what are raw intelligence reports from the battlefield, and this is material that you have to have a very good understanding of the history of the various wars in Afghanistan, what's going on now, to synthesize it. This is more than a full-time job, and this is not something that, you know, my mom, for example, can go to WikiLeaks and download this stuff and would not be able to make heads or tails of any of it. And so I do think that this WikiLeaks model is not going to replace the work that journalists or academics traditionally do. I think they do play a very important role in trying to synthesize it. What I think is new and I think is good is that everybody can now look at what is essentially the raw data, that the same data that the journalists might use to produce these stories. It might be akin to astronomers publishing the raw data from their telescope logs or things like that. And they use that data to create a series of findings, but anybody
can use that. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about how we can take on our secret government. And you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
KALW is now on Facebook. Become a Facebook fan of KALW and help spread the word about the programming that you value on local public radio. It's easy to become a fan. Either search KALW the next time you're on Facebook or follow the link to the station's page at kalw.org.
Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On tomorrow's show, Sandeep Roy will talk about what happens to hospitals when their budgets get cut. California hospitals are warning that Governor Schwarzenegger's budget will impact all patients, especially low-income patients. If you or a loved one has been to a hospital lately, we'd love to hear about your experience on tomorrow's show. And then Thursday, Arizona's SB 1070 is supposed to go into effect. We'll talk about how that law has changed our, or that bill, I should say, and law has changed our political landscape. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, today we are talking about our vast secret government. We talked about the Washington Post series on Friday called Top Secret America. It revealed that we live under a large government that is accountable to no one. And then we got WikiLeaks. They just released 90,000 pages of classified material exposing what's really happening in Afghanistan. So how can we take on our secret government? What does this really mean for our democracy? Is it possible to unravel these secrets? And if so, what should we do with that information? The number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst and Army intelligence officer. He began his service in the U.S. Army and continued in the CIA, where he worked as an analyst for 27 years. We're also joined by Trevor Paglen. He's author of Blank Spots on the Map, The Dark Geography of the Pentagon's Secret World. His latest book is called Invisible, Covert Operations and Classified Landscapes. And Ray, what about that question about what this means for our democracy? It's been interesting to watch the media explore the Washington Post series. The main question many TV hosts, for example, are asking is, isn't this putting people in danger? But the bigger question is, what does this mean for our democracy?
Well, in terms of the Washington Post series, it shows how much we have deferred to this military intelligence corporate complex, the one that Eisenhower warned us about, but couldn't quite fathom how far we would come. And, you know, a lot of the government work, some say 70% of the intelligence work, is now being formed out, contracted out, and that's incredibly mischievous. That's incredibly dangerous. There are two kinds of such contracts. One is what was encountered when George Bush went into Afghanistan and then had Iraq in his sights, and he said, we're going to be picking up a lot of bad people, evil people even, and we're going to give them the business. And so he called in the head of the CIA, George Tenet at the time, and said, you got some guys that can do this and give people the business, you know, with harsh interrogation techniques. They never say torture, of course. And so George Tenet said, well, actually, no, we haven't been doing that except sort of as a sideline down there in South America, Central America. But we got guys that know guys that they'll do just fine. And that's where you get the contractors. The contractor, CACI, CACI by short, was the one that, quote, trained, end quote, our soldiers at Abu Ghraib, and how you, quote, prepare detainees for successful interrogation, end quote. The contractors were running the torture and the kidnapping and the putting people in black holes programs with ample assistance from some CIA operations officers who were suborned into doing that because Tenet thought that he needed to do everything the president told him. And so that's the one kind of contract. Now, that's bad enough, but there's another kind of contract that's being let, and that is to do intelligence analysis, okay? And one of the interesting things coming out of here was the director of National Intelligence Office bragged about the success that they have had by hiring contractors, by hiring outside companies to do intelligence analysis. Now, what does it mean? Well, you wouldn't hire Supreme Court justices to make judgments on the law, would you? Well, you don't hire outside help to make judgments on intelligence. You rely on facts. You rely on people making inferences with no axes to grind, with no need to have a contract renewal the following year, and no felt need to come up with the, quote, correct answer, end quote, that the contracting officer or his agency or her agency might wish. So what's an example? An example is Iran. The professionals in the intelligence community have very courageously resisted attempts on the part of the neoconservatives and others who wish to paint Iran in much more dangerous colors than the evidence merits. At the end of 2007, there was a national intelligence estimate. Most people forget about that, but it said with high confidence that Iran had stopped working on the nuclear warhead part of its nuclear program. At the end of 2003, so 4 years prior, and had not resumed. Now, that stopped the war, folks. That stopped the war that was just about to be perpetrated by Dick Cheney and George Bush on Iran because it took the wind right out of everybody's sails. There is an equivalent memorandum or national intelligence estimate in preparation now, updating what the judgments were before. Now, my information is that there's no basic change. They still are not working on the warhead for a nuclear weapon. But let's say you contract, you have a request for proposal, and you send out 12 requests for proposals, and you know, it's going to be very easy to get at least two or three of those contractors to sniff the prevailing winds and tell you, oh, no, no, those professionals there, the CIA, they don't know what they're talking about. Iran is just about to get a nuclear weapon, if not tomorrow. And we can assure you the day after tomorrow. And what will happen to those contractors? Well, they will be fulfilling a need felt by those who want to give Israel the green light for war in Iran, and they'll get the contract renewed for 5 more years, and they'll make a pile of money, and they don't much care whether they're telling the truth or not. That is very, very mischievous. Look for it to happen in the next couple of weeks.
Well, we have full lines, so let's go to our first caller. Let's hear from Bradley in San Francisco. Hi, Bradley. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to ask about the
Bradley?
Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask specifically if we look at Pakistan and what the intelligence community in Pakistan views as the real danger in Afghanistan is not the Taliban and not certainly the Al-Qaeda. And the fact that that would point towards, you know, as to the real threat of the whole premise of the wars in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, that, you know, that there's this terror that we have to respond to. I think that projecting, you know, the whole premise is just serving the war on terror fiction of the intelligence system. I mean, we are spending more on disinformation and education in this country. We need to just unplug the entire intelligence world, get rid of it. We need to expose the war on terror and the intelligence involvement in these provocations against our population, like 9/11 and the bombing in 93. We see every single one of these instances are completely entangled with informers, agents, operatives. I mean, it's like a virus and a poison that's destroying our world, and we need to chop it out, get rid of it. And it's wonderful that WikiLeaks has exposed things that the media just falsely, you know, forwarded all the disinformation on friendly fire incidents that were transformed into battles, like our Canadian allies, you know, and on that we're seeing from this. It's just things that the media never even second-guessed from the intelligence disinformation that was put forward and just passed down to the public. And I'm afraid that Ray is buying into the whole premise of the wars against terror, which are baloney. I mean, you know, look, there's only 50 Al-Qaeda admitted by the intelligence people in Afghanistan. And well, so it's really time for the whole game to be, you know, chucked.
Well, Bradley, thanks for calling in. So Ray, Bradley says that you should just unplug the entire intelligence world. As someone who worked for the CIA for 27 years, what role should secret intelligence play in today's climate?
Well, there is a role, but the process and the establishment has been so corrupted over the last decade that I would agree it should be abolished. What needs to happen is not build giant databases containing every Tom, Dick, and Harry that is suspected of being a militant, but rather serious people need to address the question with respect to what makes a militant or an insurgent, you know? What makes a terrorist a terrorist? Now, if you limit yourself to finding the terrorists or the militants or whatever you call them and put them in a database and then give them to the drones and shoot them all up, you're going to get longer and longer lines at terrorist training camps, Al-Qaeda and Taliban, everybody else, okay? What needs to happen here is people have to sit down and say, now, really, why do they really hate us, you know? Why do they hate us? Why did they do 9/11? And nobody has the courage to do that because that's not a welcome answer. The answer is they don't hate us. They hate our policy, okay? They hate it when we invade their countries and occupy them. They hate us when we say publicly, as Joe Biden has recently, that there's no daylight between the policy and actions of the state of Israel on the one hand and our own policy and actions on the other. Because what they watch, what Muslims, and there are 1.3 billion of them in the world, you know, billions, what I'm saying, 1.3 billion, what they watch on their TVs in the evening are helicopter gunships, bulldozers, fighter bombers, you name it, wreaking havoc in the West Bank, in Gaza, and anywhere else Israel feels that it has the right to do that. Now, when you watch a steady diet of that, and when you realize that they wouldn't be able to do that without $3 billion a year from our country, when you realize that the bulldozers that ran over Rachel Corrie, for example, were built in Peoria, then you get this sort of feeling that, well, you know, Israel couldn't do those things without U.S. support, so the U.S. is equally an enemy. Now, I'll cite one little empirical thing here, and that is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Now, most people know that he's described as the mastermind of 9/11, okay? Now, as they were writing the 9/11 Commission report, okay, 2004, all of a sudden, in this Washington Post, it's revealed that, hey, they got him. They got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, okay? So I can just visualize the young people working on this report, say, yeah, well, we got an idea. We're supposed to find out why they did it, right? Let's ask the mastermind. And so they forward a bunch of questions to the CIA, who asked Khalid Sheikh Mohammed why he did it. And now I would ask all of your listeners to raise their hand if they know what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said. Ah, okay. Nobody's raising their hand. Well, you can find it on page 147 of the 9/11 Commission report, and this is what it says. It said, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his animus toward the United States was not due to his studying here in Greensboro, North Carolina, but by his own admission, it was due to his intense hatred, his intense violent hatred toward the policies of the United States which favor Israel. And then there's a little footnote, and it says, oh, by the way, this is what his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, said when he was condemned to 140 years in the U.S. federal penitentiary for trying to knock down one of the Twin Towers in 93, I guess it was. So look, it's not the only reason, but it's a major reason. Our identification with the policies of Israel set these people off, and nobody's willing to say that. When it came to the question, Helen Thomas, bless her heart, she asked John Brennan, who's the chief counterterrorist guy in the White House. They were talking about the Christmas bomber, Abdul Muttalib, you know, and he said, well, why did he do it? What motivates a terrorist like that, says Helen. And John Brennan said, it's their religion. They hate us. They're out to do violence. They were out to destroy the homeland. And she says, well, John, so it's religion? Well, no, it's only partly religion. It's just that they want to do us. They hate us. And Helen Thomas says, well, you still haven't told me why. And so he said, well, it's too complicated. And he was rescued by some other, well, from one of her stenographer friends who doesn't ask these questions. Now, Helen is gone, but the question remains, why do they hate us? And the last thing I'll say on this is a little simile here, a little metaphor. How do you eradicate malaria? Well, as is well known, what you do is you find the mosquitoes, and you track them down to the swamp where they breed, and then you set sharpshooters all around the swamp, and you try to shoot each one as they leave the swamp, okay? Well, that's ridiculous, isn't it? And similarly, with respect to terrorists, you don't try to shoot up all the terrorists. You find out the swamp of grievances that motivates them. You drain the swamp is what you do, and we don't even give any thought to that in our media or even, I'm sad to say, in our intelligence establishment.
And that is Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and Army intelligence officer. We are also joined today by Trevor Paglen. He is author of many books about government secrets, and we'll be talking with him about his latest book called Invisible, Covert Operations and Classified Landscapes. And if you'd like to join us, we have a line open, 866-798-8255. We're talking about government secrets today, how we can take on the secret government. And when you get information from people like Tim Shorrock, Jeremy Scahill, the Washington Post series, WikiLeaks, what do you then do with that information? What should Congress do with that information? Will they do anything with this information? The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Trevor, before we get to calls, you have visited a number of these, what you call blank spots on the map. What can you just give us a sense of what this looks like and what we need to know about?
Sure. I think it's important to realize when we're talking about government secrecy, we're not just talking about secrets. In other words, we're not just talking about information that's kept from the public. We're talking about infrastructures. We're talking about jobs. We're talking about economies as well. And when you were talking about the secret government, it has places where it actually is. I mean, it's made out of the same stuff that the rest of the world is made out of. When you're looking at the secret state, it involves everything from very banal-looking office parks and buildings, as was described in Top Secret America, the Washington Post article. But it also involves things that are a little bit stranger. For example, secret air bases out in the middle of the desert in Nevada, where nobody lives around there. People fly to work to and from there from Las Vegas every day. Two, you know, strange outposts in Afghanistan, top secret prisons, really, in old brick factories and such on the outskirts of Kabul. So we're really talking about a wide range of different places. And when you go to some of these places, some of them you would not recognize them from any other place. Other places are impossible to see with your unaided eye. In other words, they're very far away from any public land, or they're situated far inside restricted military ranges. Or other places, for example, in Afghanistan, they'll be out kind of on the plains, but generally you wouldn't want to go there, first of all, because you wouldn't have a reason to go there, and second of all, it's kind of dangerous to go there. And so it's a wide range of things. My favorite story on this was driving out to what I thought was a secret prison in Afghanistan. We had to hire a driver, somebody who'd been around. We had to find an old man who because the only old men were the people that would know this area, because you couldn't go there for so long because of the different wars. And we're driving out there, and we end up in a traffic jam. But it's not a traffic jam. It's a herd of goats. And we're waiting for the goats to go by, and we look at the goat herder and realize he's wearing a baseball hat. And we thought, well, that's pretty weird. Why is this guy wearing a baseball hat? And he finally turns around to look at the car, and on the hat are the initials KBR, which stands for Kellogg, Brown, and Root, which at the time was a subsidiary of Halliburton. And so that was a kind of funny moment. Here we are sitting in the middle of nowhere, Afghanistan, next to what we think is a secret CIA prison, and a goat herder is wearing a KBR baseball hat. And I talked to a friend of mine in the CIA a couple weeks later about that incident, and he said, you know, damn those KBR guys, I'm always getting on their case about OPSEC, in other words, operational security.
how did you find these sites?
initially, when I started doing research into what we might call this geography of this secret world, it was a curious thing. At the time, this was before there was Google Earth or widely available commercial satellite imagery, and you would use the USGS has an archive of aerial survey photography, and they have a copy of that in the building where I was working at UC Berkeley. And I would go through the image archives, and it was kind of funny because there'd be images that were taken out. In other words, there were quite literally blank spots on these USGS maps, and so it ended up being actually kind of easy because you would just look for what information was missing, and then you would, you know, of course, you'd focus your attention on that.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Steve in Big Sur. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an interesting show.
Hi, Steve.
Incidentally, you might describe what your guest was just speaking about as looking for the invisible object that casts a shadow. I wanted to posit to the guest that I think the reining in of the national security state is the great political science issue of our times, on a par with the church-state controversies of the Middle Ages, with the Magna Carta, with you know, the battle between the divine right of kings and the rise of democracy, and so forth. That, you know, we seem to have an inevitable tendency to concentrate power in secrecy. And the question will become, how do we, you know, both in small units and large over the next century or two, get that under control, lest we be run by, you know, the private warriors forever?
Well, and that raises a question about the best way to really address the ever-increasing secret government. I mean, we're living at a time when just 24 hours after this top-secret America story ran, the Senate's Intelligence Committee removed a provision from the Intelligence Authorization Act, which would have given the Government Accountability Office oversight over the government's secret intelligence programs, and the GAO is the investigative arm of Congress. So if you can't even get that in a bill, because Obama threatened to veto the bill if that were included, how do you address this issue, Trevor?
I agree that with the caller completely, in the sense that when we look at the kind of origins of the contemporary secret state, really with the Manhattan Project and the real its real architecture going back to things like the National Security Act of 1947, the Central Intelligence Agency Act of 1949, you see a basically an unimpeded growth of that secret state within the state over its entire lifespan. The budget of the intelligence world and these secret parts of the military has fluctuated with defense spending overall, but it has consistently consumed a greater portion of the overall budget. In other words, in the 1990s, for example, when the overall military budgets went down, the budgets for the secret part also went down, but as an overall proportion of the budget, they actually increased. And so I think that the caller is right in terms of that secret state has been gaining more and more power, become much more a part of the fundamental structure of the government and part of what we might, you know, what there is on the books being the legitimate functions of the state for a long time, to the point now where it's very difficult to even recognize where that secret state ends and the rest of the state begins. In terms of how to challenge that, I think it's very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult to challenge something that is secret and that is entirely kind of under the control of the executive branch and that the executive branch derives an enormous amount of power from. At the moment, I think the best bet is the court system, and I think that judges really need to insist on their right to oversee this and to actually take on cases that the executive branch consistently argues for throwing out. We're seeing that right now in several cases in San Francisco and before the Ninth Circuit, and particularly a case called Muhammad versus Jepson, which was a guy who was kidnapped by the CIA and tortured for years and is suing a company called Jepson who had done the logistics for that. Honestly, beyond that, one can imagine this going to an international level. In other words, if the American court system does not address things like torture that has been done by the American state, it's conceivable that some of these cases could show up under some of the universal jurisdiction clauses in other countries.
When you have visited these black sites and you've written these books, I mean, the first book you wrote, Torture Taxi on the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights, first book to describe the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. How do you even wrap your arms around this? I mean, and do citizens have the power to do anything about this? I mean, you before the show, you said the question has to be, is Congress going to do anything about this?
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about the secrecy system, we're talking about a part of the state which functions outside of the normal checks and balances of the way that the state is supposed to be set up. Even something like the black budget, its constitutionality has never been actually addressed in the courts. If you look at the Constitution's receipts and expenditures clause is very clear that you have to publish all the receipts of all government expenditures, and the black budget seems to flagrantly contradict that. The reason I bring up the courts as the best approach towards dealing with this secret state is that I just have very, very little faith in Congress's ability to do this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for the call. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We've got about 10 minutes left. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Trevor Paglen. He's written many books about the secret government. His latest is a photographic monograph called Invisible, Covert Operations and Classified Landscapes. It's filled with pictures of these black sites. We're also joined by Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and Army intelligence officer. He's now heading up Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. He's speaking out against corruption in the CIA. And let's go to our next caller, George in Berkeley. Hi, George.
Oh, hi. I wanted to ask if you people would please address the question, did Muslims do it on 9/11? Because every message we're getting from Ray McGovern and from you and your other guest just takes that as a given. Even when your first caller said this war on terror is a sham, what are they doing with that secret money? Are the terrorists in the Pentagon? Is the left progressives infiltrated by people like Ray McGovern and Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill and even the director of WikiLeaks, who recently said, oh, 9/11 is just a distraction? But they're called the 9/11 wars. And if Americans understood that perhaps Muslims didn't do it, that supplemental appropriation going through Congress right now wouldn't pass. But as long as people say, well, they attacked us, well, sure, well, if you've got to lie us into a war in Iraq, or if you have to torture, or if you have to have drone pilots dropping bombs on wedding parties in Afghanistan, well, that's what we have to do because they attacked us.
Ray McGovern?
Well, the man makes a very good point. 9/11 has never been investigated. The 9/11 Commission was a cover-up, and you don't have to believe me about that. Just listen to the co-chair, Hamilton, and Governor, the other fellow. Both of them have written a book saying we weren't given enough time, weren't given enough people, weren't given enough money. We were doomed to fail. And it did fail. It didn't come to the right conclusions. It didn't address some of the issues that I just addressed. On page 147, it does mention Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and what he said, but everything is just brushed over. So what needs to happen is an independent commission to get to the bottom of this, a really independent commission, and I applaud those who are fighting for that. Now, that having been said, I'd like to go back just a little ways here to what I think is missing here in the body politic, and that is character. You know, character counts. We used to say that about Bill Clinton and all that. Character counts. Integrity counts. The judges have shown that, they're sort of political animals now. It depends on who appoints them, and that's why the state secrets privilege is being invoked willy-nilly. What needs to happen is we have to go back to the first article of the Constitution, which gives the Congress all kinds of rights, many more rights than in the other branches. And what has happened here is that they have sort of ducked those responsibilities. The National Security Act of 1947 was mentioned. That act was a hybrid. It created an agency that Truman wanted to create to give him accurate information without fear or favor on what's going on abroad. But it also included, by historical accident, a group of people who, courageous during World War II, they came into the agency as the covert action folks. And one sentence was inserted into the National Security Act of 1947, giving the president the possibility of using this covert action arm. And I do not hesitate to say this, because Truman said it himself, as the president's own personal Gestapo. And that's what we have here. That sentence reads, "The director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties as the president shall from time to time direct," period, end quote. That is the, quote, justification, end quote, for the president telling a fellow like George Tenet, who thought he had to do everything the president told him, to kidnap people, to assassinate them, put them in black holes, whatever. They can do it. The only check, and this is where the integrity, this is where the character comes in, the only check is in the committees of Congress, who are supposed to be exercising oversight. What they're exercising is overlook. There hasn't been a real oversight committee job done on intelligence for 10 years. And who is it? It's Dianne Feinstein. Now, I think she's from your state, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
Yeah. It's Jane Horman. I think she's also from your state.
Right.
And worse, the worst disappointment, because he didn't come across as a politician at first, is Leon Panetta, head of the CIA. They are letting the CIA do all the kinds of things that Bush asked them to do. And what happens is, since there are a bunch of con people in the CIA, that's the trade, you know, you con people into suborning their own country. These con people go down to Congress and they say, "Now, Senator Feinstein, we want you to know that we're using special techniques here on these prisoners. We're trying to get information. We know you want us to get right. Okay, then 2 months later comes out, we're torturing people like no one since the Inquisition." And Dianne Feinstein is about to make a public announcement, and they go, Senator Feinstein, don't you remember that on June 8th and June 10th, we briefed you on this? So, and you raised no objection. They make them complicit. And then Dianne Feinstein, Jane Harmon, Leon Panetta, the whole bunch of them, just fudge the thing and keep it out of the public arena and let these people go off and do what they want with all the money that no one is willing to put the kibosh on, saying this war on terror is a charade. We're not going to give any more money to these folks.
Hmm. Well, where does that leave us, Trevor? When you have all of this information, you've written books about this. We have WikiLeaks now. Clearly, I mean, we're getting emails and calls. People are very skeptical about the, quote, war on terror. Apolitical people don't believe what they're being told, including people in my family who weren't very political, who are now, you know, watching videos on YouTube and things, saying things they've never said before. Where does this leave us? What can we do about this?
I'm sorry to say that I don't have much of an answer to that. I think that there are good signs on the horizon, perhaps. I think WikiLeaks is a productive thing. To me, it's amazing that WikiLeaks has actually happened, in the sense that I remember when they started WikiLeaks, I thought to myself, oh, that's a good idea, but it seems like it will never be more than perhaps a little online cabinet of curiosities, of strange intelligence documents that aren't really going to make sense or have no context around them. So I think it is encouraging to see that it's actually becoming a part of the media landscape and is kind of changing the way that we can get information and the way that we can understand our own country, I guess. So I think those are some signs in the positive direction.
What would have to happen for something to change? Because we're getting videos of soldiers shooting innocent people. We've got the photos from Abu Ghraib. We've got information about spending on contractors that's being completely wasted. There are tablets of dollars that are being wasted. I mean, the information is out there.
Right. I think historically, the there's really one moment where you can look to where Congress really did try to wrap their hands around this intelligence establishment, and that was the mid-1970s with the Church and Pike hearings. And there is a lot of legislation that actually did come out of that, which was quite productive in terms of trying to create some oversight over the intelligence agencies. Of course, what happened was that when Reagan and particular Bill Casey came to power in the 1980s, they basically told Congress to go to hell and did what they wanted to do anyway. And that we know where that led, you know, with the culmination with Iran-Contra. And really after Iran-Contra, I think there was a big failure of Congress.
There was a bill, Glenn Greenwald just wrote about this over at Salon.com, a bill that would cut out 10% of the private contractors, and it died. Mm-hmm. Just 10%.
Right.
So if you can't get that bill passed, then what do you do?
Ray, do you have any ideas?
And we have just about a minute left, Ray.
Well, there are two classes of people in this country. There are people who are profiteering from the war. There are people who don't give a darn about the war. And then there are the young people from the towns in this country of less than 50,000 and from the inner city who are subjected to a poverty draft. Those are the people who are dying and getting wounded in these places. And you know what? Nobody important has any skin in the game. Unlike Vietnam, nobody's son, nobody's uncle, nobody's father is fighting. We're hired, these folks, because they had no economic or educational opportunity. What needs to happen is people with some integrity, some sense of justice in this country needs to stand up and say, that's wrong. That's completely wrong. And it's not only wrong, it's what the founding fathers dreaded when they talked about never having a standing army. We need some kind of army for defense, but we shouldn't be sending all these young people over to Iraq or Afghanistan or, God forbid, Iran, just as a way of securing the provision of natural resources, oil and natural gas that we need from that part of the world.
And, Ray, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll be furthering this discussion on our Friday Media Roundtable. That's Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst. Trevor Paglen is the author of a number of books about government secrets. His latest is called Invisible. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's show. What happens to hospitals when their budgets are drastically slashed? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how hospitals are coping as they're faced with cuts affecting everything from mental health services to Medi-Cal. California hospitals are warning that Governor Schwarzenegger's budget will impact all patients, especially low-income patients. If you or a loved one has been to a hospital lately, what was the experience like? Join us at 11 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. How are hospitals coping? It's Your Call with Sandy Broy and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer, and Tamal Kanshu is our intern. Pete Misick is our web editor, Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.